Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. This is a recording of a Shabbat teaching by Rabbi Cantor Hilary Chorney.
I got kind of cute with the title. I said something's fishy because we're going to learn a little bit about fish. And I'm excited. And you happen to be eating tuna, which is a great food for this teaching. So, okay. All right. So, we have a monument to the tuna. Okay, we might get there in our learning. We'll see. So, in the Torah, we have different types of rules around kashrut, around dietary laws. Sometimes those dietary laws are a list of animals that we are prohibited to eat. There are animals that no matter how you slice them, literally, you cannot eat them according to the kashrut laws, according to dietary laws. There are also rules about how one must go about doing kosher slaughter when the animal is within permissibility. And also, in addition to how one does that, how those foods need to be kept separate from dairy foods. Right? That many, many times in our Torah, we're instructed that we should not boil a kid in its mother's milk, which is to say that we learn from the Torah over and over again that somehow meat and the milk of animals should be separated from one from the other. In addition to that, there's this other category that we see in this parasha, the category pertaining to creatures that swim in the sea and bodies of water. And for those, it is neither here nor there. We are neither permitted to eat whatever and slaughter them however, nor are they a list of prohibited animals, but rather rules around how one determines whether this is a creature from the sea that can be eaten according to kashrut or not. In Vayikra, the very first source on your paper, chapter 11, verse 9, et zeh tochlu, this you shall eat, which is to say, this you are permitted to eat, mikol asher b'mayim, from within all that is found in the waters. So this is already setting up the category that I'm laying out for you from the beginning. There is a category of animals that you may or may not be able to eat, and the Torah is going to tell us explicitly how we know, can we eat this creature, can we not eat this creature? Kol asher lo sinapir b'kas keset. Each that has on it, with it, somehow visible, sinapir v'kas keset, we'll leave those untranslated for a moment, ba'mayim, in the water, bayamim uvanechalim, whether you're talking about seas or you're talking about rivers, which is to say whether you're talking about saltwater fish or you're talking about freshwater fish. And also I would say, due reference, because you gotta laugh or also cry from the river to the sea. The idea of from river bodies to the sea may in and of itself be what's called a merism. And a merism is like when we say you should teach these words to your children from when you get up in the morning till when you lay down at night, which is a way of the Torah telling us all the time, all inclusive between those two points. So it may be pertaining to that, it may not. That's not what we're gonna get into for today, but you should understand that they're not saying, oh, well, I don't see any lakes listed here. So obviously we can only eat animals that are in the great sea, which is like a salty body of water, or in a river. Instead, it's more of a categorical and inclusive phrase. So whether it's salt water or fresh water, otam tochelu, those are the ones you can eat. We're going to use Rashi's translation from the 11th to 13th century to understand what sinapir and kaskaset are. Sinapir, according to him, are elu sheshat bahem. This is what the fish uses to Floofy, it's over. To, you know, go back and forth. The swish, swish. Well, it's the swish, swish. It's the, it's fins of some order, right? It's got to have fins of, on some order. And kas keset, what is that? Elu klipin hakevu imbo kemoshene emar. This verse from Shmuel. Veshiron kas kasim hu lavush. These are the things that have little scalies that are attached to it, affixed to it, as it says in the book of Samuel, and then uses a garment that human beings wear, which I can only picture. It's really chainmail, but I'm picturing fabulous sequins because that's the only thing I can picture when I think of a giant scaly outfit. They're really probably talking about a chainmail, right? That was what he was wearing. And he was clothed in a scaly coat of mail, which is to say, kaskeset, like the thing that we see on a fish. You can learn what one Hebrew word means from another biblical word. Sometimes it's a stretch, sometimes it's not. Here they say, what are we talking about when we're talking about the thing on the clothing? We're talking about little scaly bits. So it's like a, it's an internal to the Torah definition and understanding. It's not just Rashi, as he sometimes say, the laws in the local language, like in French, this is what we call X, Y, and Z, and you just sort of have to trust Rashi. He says, no, we actually use this word throughout the Bible, and when we use it, we're referring to scaly little bits of things. Okay, so can we eat fish? What's the answer to that question? The answer is sometimes it depends on the fish. So a yes and no. Yes, we can sometimes eat fish, but it depends on the type of fish. The Sefer HaChinuch, which is this early-ish medieval long letter-formed Spanish communication between a father and son, ostensibly. It was like writing an ethical will that was ultimately used by the Jewish people. It's considered a work of halakha, of Jewish law. The Sefer HaChinuch, when he outlines this commandment, what he gets stuck on is something fascinating, which is whether or not it's considered a mitzvah to eat kosher fish. So when he goes to pick it apart, he says, leave dok b'simanei dagim, to check the mitzvah b'rikat simanei dagim. Pausing on this for a second, the way that the Sefer HaChinuch is organized is with pertaining to every mitzvah that's found in each parasha in order of the phrase or the word to which that can be attributed or that it's hooked upon. And this is according to the counting of Maimonides. So he uses the Maimonidean accounting of the positive commandments. But something weird happens here. He says, as for this checking of the signs of the dagim, the fish, leave dok b'simanei dagim kelomar sheharotze le'echol min hadagim. That is to say that the one who wishes to eat from the species of fish, sheyiv dok techila bahen, that they should first check in it, that is the creature, yafe, check well, hasimanim shenatna hatorah bahen, the characteristics that the Torah ascribed to fish, vehen, and what are those characteristics that we're checking? Sinapir v'kaskeset. Sinapir v'kaskeset. Okay. So what does maybe the Sefer HaChinuch think is the mitzvah in regards to eating fish? Is it that it's a mitzvah to eat fish? No. Is it that it's a negative mitzvah, that you should not eat fish? No. He makes the mitzvah to do with the category that this is in. It's not that you can eat it depending on how it's slaughtered or you're not permitted to eat the thing. He says that the mitzvah is to do the checking. And then he gives us this verse, Shene Emar, the one that we just read, Etzeh tochlu mikol asher b'mayim v'chule. This verse that we just read in Vayikra that tells us that. Kivar. Katavnu b'mitzvah hakodemet lazo. We already wrote in the last mitzvah about this. And he's going to say what the this is, Sheha Ramban, that Nachmanides, who comes after our friend who died, delineated all the mitzvot that the Sefer HaChinuch is relying on. Zichro no livracha, may his memory be for a blessing. Lo yachshov b'minyan hamitzvot b'dikat simanim b'minim shehitira haTorah. That Ramban, the Nachmanides, not to be confused with Rambam, did not. What's minyan? It's a gathering, but how many? 10. Okay, so what do we do when we want to make sure, like right now, when I look around the room, what am I doing? What's a minyan? It's the counting. Okay, so when he accounted for all of the mitzvot, which he was trying to get to, let's be honest, he was trying to get to those 613 and going for the number 613 and figuring out which one was counted within that. How do you divide them up? There is a significant amount conflict isn't the word I'm looking for, disagreement on paper between rabbinic authorities as to which count in the 613 and which don't. Ramban says, this isn't a mitzvah. You're making it up, Maimonides. Very cute that you're, I'm adding words to his words, but it's lovely that you think that this could be a mitzvah, because of course we are required to check, but he doesn't see it as a mitzvah. Because, and he goes on to explain this, we're not going to pick apart the entire piece from Sefer HaChinuch, but he basically says that you can find in the Gemara, and he gives this example from Chulin from the Gemara, that they say this is a positive commandment or this is a negative commandment, and then give some examples of places where that shows up and it doesn't show up here, and therefore it's not a commandment. So we don't even really have a commandment in regards to eating fish or not eating fish. What we have, I mean, there are other bits to consider, but based on this, it's not necessarily a command. And what might you extrapolate from that? What does that mean for fish and for the eating of fish? Is it a command? Why is it not a mitzvah? How could it be that we don't have a mitzvah when it comes to eating kosher fish or not? That's the number one response to this is that in an ideal world, and we do not live in an ideal world, but in an ideal world, that there's sort of rungs on a ladder of how one ought to be choosing the foods that they eat. And at the highest, most rung of that ladder, you have the version of eating that was commanded to people before the flood and immediately after, right? The Noahide laws, the rules that were set in place, which seem to outline God's preference, God's strong preference, that in a world where we don't need to eat animals, we don't eat animals. So you might come to say that we shouldn't be commanded to eat fish because we don't have to eat fish. Also, what happens if you live in Iowa? I guess Iowa has rivers and lakes and things like that. What happens if you live in the middle of a large stretch in what we now call Nevada, right? Right, you get your meat from Minneapolis, right? You may or may not, in the world of the Sefer HaChinuch, have had access to fish. And therefore, what's the problem if you have a commandment that's listed in the Torah that requires you to check fish? And the Torah isn't asking you, personally, or any one of us, to imagine that we shouldn't eat animals. I want to be clear about that. I don't think that the rabbinic interpretation says, and therefore we should all be vegetarians. I think that they actually see us in the form of many different things that take place in the Torah as not living on the human plane in the ideal order of things. In this version of humanity, we eat animals. We do. And that's why we have all these rules around what we can eat and not eat, because we do eat those animals. Mm-hmm. And this is just imagining from God's perspective, well, we probably don't want to command people to eat animals. I think the more catchy reason here, I'm going to keep throwing in fish-related jokes, the more catchy reason here is that we do our best not to assign mitzvot that cannot be acted upon, even the mitzvot, and I'll come to your comment, even the mitzvot that pertain to the temple. We are still teaching, and these are hundreds and hundreds of years after the temples were destroyed, Sefer HaChinuch concerns itself with whether or not we should understand if the temple were in order, here would be our commandment. So even in that universe, it's possible that we might come across. I think that's Rambam's reasoning, by the way, is if you're eating fish, then you should, this mitzvah exists. Anyway, you had a thought. Right. Can you practically determine the kashrut, the dietary fitness of a fish before you catch it? The answer is no, particularly if you want to use the image, which we're going to get to in a few minutes, of a net, not a fishing rod with a hook, because you're scooping up a substantial number of fish, and then from that, you have fish that slip out and escape. You have fish that are not kosher with it, and then you may also have fish that are. And so it's true also that the checking is really only post facto, and so there's what to be considered there as well. I like that, Rosemary, and then we're going to move on. So Rosemary brings up two issues. One of those issues is what happens in a universe where fish are being farm-raised, and then therefore you know from the start. And then two is, of course, when you go to a marketplace and you can't necessarily tell by the way that the fish looks sitting there on ice or whatever, ideally, you can't tell necessarily if it's the kosher fish. I almost taught for the, I shied away from, I deleted it from the sheet, but could teach another time about whether or not salmon can be considered kosher on site, because it's one of the few fish for which the flesh is determinably kosher, even without the scales on it, because of the pigmentation that exists in salmon today. But that aside, what I would say is perhaps the rabbis of the medieval era and earlier would have been delighted by the idea of farm-raised fish, because then lehatchila, a priori, before you even get there, you're able to do the thing that you just told us we cannot do by catching fish. If you go out to the sea and you're trying to catch fish, you don't know yet, even before you've caught it, whether it's kosher or not. But if you are farming tilapia, if you are farming salmon, et cetera, which they did in ancient times, is that... Right, exactly. There are fish farms in Kisari. I'm just repeating things for the podcast / the people online. Exactly, and so I think that there's something to that idea. Actually, picturing right the engineered market of fish, and it's also the case that just as with so many other things in halacha, you cannot necessarily determine the kashrut even based on the literature that was in our that we were sharing with one another, the oral Torah of 600 by the time of the Gemara, or even by the time of the Sefer HaChinuch or Shulchan Aruch, which we'll look at in a moment, right? Even by medieval times, that's not enough, because the situation in regards to food access, among many other things, is constantly changing, which is why the matter of whether or not a food is kosher is very typically a reference to the local rabbi of the time, because food science, so to speak, and food access is constantly changing. I need to move us to the next topic. I know people have other thoughts, but I've got to move on. Otherwise, we're going to run out of time to talk about what I really want to talk about today, which is, if it's true that we can eat fish, some fish, why is it that fish are not one of the sacrificial animals that are listed? You're cheating? Okay, then I'm going to ban you from contributing until, I'm just kidding. You can contribute as much as you'd like to, honestly or not, but I'm glad you're cheating. Do you see where I'm going with this?
Well, I do.
You do see where I'm going. Okay.
I'm eager in anticipation.
Okay, great. I'm very excited to explore this. I'm bothered by the notion that fish aren't even considered by the Torah. We don't even get a rejected. This fish, this you shall not bring, nothing. The fish aren't even brought up, and it clearly is on the minds of many of the rabbis who are considering what ought to be korbanot or not to be korbanot. What's the deal? Be very Seinfeldian about it. What's the deal with fish? Like, why are fish such an exceptional category? And we're going to get some reasoning about this starting on the next page. But Rosemary has a thought. Great. I love those two ideas. One is that fish in some cultures are considered to be about the dumbest creatures that exist, and therefore we wouldn't utilize them for korbanot because they don't represent well.
I think you're going to be surprised on the reasoning based on that thought. And two, which I love, I've never considered, as we read in this week's Torah portion, blood is an extremely vital part, literally and figuratively, of how we offer sacrifices. So fish, I don't know how many of you have experienced this, but while they're messy to in the form of slaughter, so to speak, they're not necessarily bloody, and that leaves us perhaps wanting in the sacrificial system. We're going to skip right to Rabbi Dina Weiss's explanation of why fish don't show up as sacrifices in this new system of Se'udah Shlishit, where I am the only person who is mic'd for purposes of online, etc. I'm going to go ahead and read it, even though I would delight if someone else was reading, but I apologize for hearing a lot of my voice. Okay, here we go. With this lens in mind, talking about what fish are and aren't utilized for, we're going to take this one paragraph at a time. We need to return to what fish represent to understand why they would be considered unfit for korbanot, that is to say, sacrifices. Just as we don't bring animals of prey, bringing up another category that we don't sacrifice, such as, let's say, vulture, scavenging type animals, so too we don't bring fish. The carnivorous animals are disqualified because they represent violence and the thirst for blood, and the fish are disqualified because they represent invulnerability. I'm going to pick it apart. She's going to spend a whole paragraph telling you what she thinks invulnerability means. And by the way, I also don't understand it on face value, Rosa, because to be invulnerable is to be untouchable, so to speak. And you can, in fact, as we have established, catch, kill, and eat a fish. So what does she mean by an invulnerability? Here's what she says. Being invulnerable is incompatible with sacrifice for two reasons. The first is that sacrifices are often brought to atone for sins. The animals and birds which are brought come to facilitate a human being's stating that they acknowledge their responsibility. Pause there for a second. When you bring a korban, with the exception of the zevach todah, the gratitude offering, the vast majority of our sacrifices are done to return a person to a less sinful state. It is an offering of something of quality and value so that we can say that we are placing on this creature a sense of apology, a sense of offering resource and value up to the divine, because we have somehow messed up or deprived the divine in the system. We have not acted as we needed to act, and therefore we're offering over this thing of value, a life force of value to atone for a sin. They understand, by they, she means the animals and the birds, but also the human beings, that they have done something wrong and have come forward to admit it. A fish sliding its way through nets and past hooks, owned by no one, hold your thought on that one, and able to avoid most threats, does not signify the taking of responsibility, and instead represents evading consequences and gestures to the ability to getting away without, quote unquote, being caught. What do we mean when we say, oh, that person, I don't know that we use this so much nowadays, but just go with me. That's a real slippery criminal. What do we mean by that when we say a slippery criminal? Hard to get a grasp of. Do we think of them as being held accountable?
No.
It's somebody who we can't even get to the point of holding them accountable. And it can mean many, many different things. But anybody who gets away with wrongdoing because we don't have a way to hold them accountable in the system, we don't have a proper way to catch them, so to speak, is considered slippery. And this is the thing to which Dina Weiss is referring, this idea that fish, they sort of like, even if you're farm raising fish, you know, you don't like point out, oh, that's the fish I'm going after. And then you're constantly keep your eyes on Fred the fish. And you're like, oh, you shouldn't name him. But anyway, like if you're going to eat him, but like like, you don't see this one fish that's in the system and go, I'm going to catch that someday. They wrote a whole book about that, right? So, like, Moby Dick is this is the exception to the rule, this idea that there are people out there who are going after one particular fish. For the most part, though, you're sort of like pulling up a net, and whoever gets caught, and there are those who are slippery. And if we were to offer a fish as a sacrifice, it is to say, this is just the one that we caught. And that somehow is not representative in the system of sacrifices of what ought to be represented by a sacrifice, which is a purposeful bringing in repentance for one's wrongdoing. But she says a second thing, which is a cousin to this, that I find even more compelling and interesting. I will see what you guys think. The second reason is that korbanot function to cement the relationship between human beings and their creator. Let's pick that sentence apart and turn it into simpler English. The reason that sacrifices, the reason that she's going to bring is that sacrifices, the job of sacrifices, is to re-strengthen or repair the relationship between God and human being. Who is in charge, God or humanity? I wish humanity was in charge. God is in charge. In other words, if we do wrong, we are accountable to God, not the other way around, unfortunately. More fortunately, what a great system to be in. So God is meant to be the Baal, the master in the relationship. God is the master. We are, and as we sing about all throughout the High Holy Days, and we are God's creatures that God is master over. In the paradigm that's set up from the very first book of the Torah, we are the masters, and the creatures of the earth, including the fish of the sea, are responsible to us. However, there's something different about fish in that system than the other animals on the earth. And I think, though she doesn't go about writing this explicitly, you can also apply it to most animals of prey. An animal which has been cared for and relies on its owner to provide for it, an animal which understands what it means, the animal understands what it means to belong to someone else, is fitting for a sacrifice. What's the word that we use to describe animals nowadays that fall into this category?
Pets.
Oh, pets is interesting. I want you to imagine for a second that you live on 50 acres in Minnesota. Do you only have pets, or do you perhaps have other creatures that belong to you?
Yeah, cows.
What do we call those animals?
Livestock.
Okay, great. And that's sort of their purpose. I would say the general category that we're probably talking about, I'm being very Socratic here, but I'm trying to get out the word domesticated. Okay, domestic. What does domesticated mean? You could have a domesticated. I agree. I think this does not account for, like, my first fish was Perpy, the betta fish. I think this does not account for it. I agree. Yes. And domesticated animals are those animals which, as she points out, understand to a certain degree, even if their understanding is just, this is the place where those humans give me food in a bowl, that's a domesticated animal that understands a belonging to a someone else, and that it's that categorically which makes a creature fitting for being offered. She goes on to say, relationships are built and strengthened by the acts of caring for one another. A carefree fish, setting aside the fish who might live in your fish tank, who I don't know if they're carefree or not, does not have its needs provided for by humans. A fish does not represent the vulnerability required for a deep and lasting relationship. A fish doesn't stay to care and be cared for, and a fish is always swimming away. Now listen, do I think that there are exceptions to this rule? Of course there are. There are actually full-on historical court cases of relationships that people had with sea creatures, okay? We have so many stories individually and in our families of little creatures, you know, whether it was the hermit crab, again, not kosher, but I'm pointing out what it means for a creature of the sea to have a relationship with a human being. I think that there are plenty of examples. You could also go back to Moby Dick, but those are the exceptions to the category of fish. Fish are invulnerable in that they cannot be guaranteed to be caught in the way that if you are keeping livestock, you can. Whether or not you want to bring them to slaughter is another story, but if you want to bring one of your livestock to slaughter, you can do that because you are the master and they are the creature. We are never, according to Dina Weiss's understanding, and I like where she goes with this, we're never completely the master of a fish. So it's actually, I would say, Rosemary, somewhat the opposite, to a certain degree, of the notion that fish are the dumbest creatures that can be. It's not exactly the opposite. It's saying something different. It's saying fish are the masters of their own domain. We are not actually their masters. And because they're the masters of their own domain, whatever salty or unsalty water they might be in, we don't offer them as sacrifices in the same way. Now, lest you think that this is a lone voice on the notion of what does and does not matter in the relationship between fish and human being, what she points out in addition are a series of sources that we're going to end our learning with about fish and the way that the Torah itself and that the Tanakh, the bigger biblical canon, acknowledges fish as a metaphorical and relational creature to the human being. How do we think of the fish according to the Torah? I'm going to go back to something that I said in the beginning. It's one thing for Rashi to come along and say, oh, kas keset, that means X. It's another thing for Rashi to say, oh, kas keset, well, if you look in the book of, what do we say, Shmuel, then you see that this is what's used as reference. Using similar reasoning, we're going to look at the way that fish and human beings are portrayed one to the other. So we're looking at Brachot 28. This is a piece from the Babylonian Talmud, from Brachot, the very first tractate as we enumerate them. The 20th page, Rabbi Yossi bar Rabbi Chanina Amar Mehacha. So Rabbi Yossi, he happened to be the son of Rabbi Chanina, but he said in the name of Rabbi Chanina. That's a funny translation. V'yidgu larov bekerev haaretz. Is it familiar? We use it in our liturgy all the time. The what is yidgu larov bekerev haaretz? Ma dagim shebayam. That the yidgu, which we say is a multiplication, is a reference to the dagim, the fish, shebayam, mayim, mechasin alehan, the ein ein hara, sholetet bahem. Just like those fish that are in the sea, water covers them, and there is no ayin hara, there's no evil eye that has sholetet bahem, that, like we were saying, kind of has a dominion over them. Af zaro shal Yosef, ein ayin hara sholetet bahem. So, and thusly, did the seed of Joseph, as in us, which is an interesting thing to refer to. I don't have the time to pick apart why we're saying the seed of Joseph and not another reference to who B'nai Yisrael are, the Israelites. The evil eye also has no dominion over who? Just like the evil eye has no dominion over fish, it has no dominion over the Jewish people. So because the fish somehow are free from the evil eye, because they have the cover of the water, the image here is that we too, as B'nai Yisrael, have a kind of covering, alike or akin to the waters of the sea, covering us and protecting us from ayin hara, which isn't literally an evil eye, but rather a sense of cursedness in the universe. Habakkuk, looking at the book of our prophet, sorry, usually I try to stay in chronological order of sources. Habakkuk is clearly hundreds and hundreds of years before Brachot, so my apologies. So this reference that is going to somewhat explain the piece in Brachot, but ta'ase adam kidge hayam, you've made humanity like what? The fish of the sea, karemis lo moshalbo, like creeping things, like the crawly things on the earth, that's also like the snakes of the earth, that have nothing that rules over them. Kulo b'chacha he'ala, yegorehu b'chermo, v'asfehu b'michmarto, alkein nismach v'agil. God has fished them all up with some sort of a fishing line, pulled them up into a type of a dragging netting, and gathered them all up in sort of this divine net. That is why alkein Yizabeach lechermo. That's why he sacrifices to this trawl, this collective. Vikater lamichmarto kivahema shamein chalko mahalo biyira. And he makes offerings to that net, because through these, the person who makes the offering, their portion is rich and their nourishment is like the fat of creatures. The real proof in this text is just the notion that there is a one-to-one metaphor offered by Habakkuk, that who are we like? We are like the fish of the sea, which is to extend an answer to the question, why don't we sacrifice fish? Because they are, according to our prophet Habakkuk, our likeness in this world as creatures. Our likeness as this world of creatures, therefore makes us uncomfortable to offer them as sacrifices. Two last texts and we'll end. From Avodah Zarah, another place in the Talmud, Rabbi Yehuda says that Shmuel says, what is the meaning when it is written in Habakkuk, that text that we looked at, and makes people as the fish of the sea, as the creeping things that have no ruler over them? Why are people, lama nimshalu b'nei adam kidgei hayam? Why are people compared to the fish of the sea? This just goes to say to you, just as with regard to the fish of the sea, once they arise onto dry land, they die immediately, so too is it with people. But what can we not live without? You would think that's what they would say, but no. Here we get the real spiritual answer to the question, as opposed to a practical answer to the question. We cannot live without words of Torah and mitzvot, because those who do not have it die immediately. I'm going to pause at that and not offer the other explanation because we're out of time to do so, but I'll just say the Torah loves to compare Torah itself to water. We cannot go without water. And I think that that's pretty apt, because this is not your only place, but there are many, many, many sources which will tell us. For example, we don't go 3 days without hearing Torah chanted. Why? Because a human being cannot go 3 days without water. The notion is we actually do dry up, so to speak, spiritually without that water. And now we're going to look at one final explanation from Avodah Zarah. This is from the next page. We're skipping over the little piece as a continuation of it. Another thing, Devar Acher, Ma Dagim Shabayam. Just as in the case of the fish of the sea, any fish that is bigger than another swallows the other, this is also the case for humanity. Were it not for the fear of the government, anyone who is bigger than another would swallow the other. Forget about the political commentary for a second. It's a commentary on human nature, that the nature of humanity is just as one big fish swallows a smaller fish, the bigger, stronger human being will swallow up, when given the opportunity, the next smaller one. And this, they say, is why we learned in Avot that Rabbi Chanina, the deputy high priest, would say one should pray for the continued welfare of the government, as were it not for fear of the government, every person would ish et re'ehu chayim bla'o, would swallow up the life of the next person. So, we would drown in water. And that's why the comparison is not to what happens with us in water, but rather humanity and Torah. So the takeaway from this, from the notion of why we can eat fish, but we don't sacrifice fish, from my perspective, is not because fish fall into this category of such an undesirable creature that we would never deign them to be fit for our consuming them, you know, offering them up as a sacrifice. They're not perfect enough, for example, or there are too many blemishes, all the other reasons that could be brought, but rather because we are too alike to fish and fish are too alike to us. And what I love about this explanation is that it's both the case that there is a positive connotation, the notion that we are like the fish of the sea because we are protected from the evil eye, just as the fish are also somewhat protected by the water that's all around them, but also that human beings have the power to slip away and not get caught in their sins. and also to swallow one another up when they are given enough power and enough authority. So the next time that you're considering a fish, I hope that you have an opportunity to consider how the fish are like you and how you are alike to the fish and why that might be the reason why dagim are not a part of the sacrificial system. Shabbat shalom. What fun learning about something fishy.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.